Brevity codes are designed to convey complex information with a few words or codes. Think of it as a short hack to key information. On this podcast, it's about sharing insights, success stories, and personal journeys across a broad spectrum of disciplines. Welcome to the Brevity Code. Hello, what's up, everybody out there? Welcome to another episode of the Brevity Code podcast. Today, I'm joined by a good friend of mine and a really dynamic and great dude who's got a great story, and we're going to dive into that today. His name is Cameron Verde. He's a SoCal local, born and raised. He's the founder of Progenix, if you remember that great brand, which we're going to get all into the history and origin of today, and the COO, former COO of Liquid IV, which if you don't know what that is, you've got to be living in a cave or never been to Costco or any of the big box stores that it's found in. Welcome to the show, Cameron. What's up, dude?
What's up, Ryan? Great to be here with you. I appreciate and honored that you have me as a guest.
Well, you know, we've been friends for a while, and we used to do our hikes until I moved, and I found our conversations so I don't know, man, like just cathartic, and you're just a great dude and a fountain of wisdom, and I thought having you on would be great just to share your origin story and just some of the nuggets that you impart on me. Have imparted on me in the past.
Well, I appreciate that, Ryan. And like I said, I'm honored to be here. And you know, you've always shed great insights to me. And you can only be as good as the people around you. So I'm fortunate to have you.
And I can hear a little scratch in your voice. We came back from a trade show last night. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I apologize. Back from a trade show and just more conversations. I'm thankful to have the conversations, but loud environments, a lot of conversation tends to put strain on the throat. So I apologize in advance if it sounds horrible.
And I'm getting over a cold, so I'm nasally. So this should be awesome for those of you listening, out there. Let's dive right in. So I really am excited to get into the Progenix side of things for a lot of reasons. We can kind of get into that. But I think before we do that, let's take a minute and set up before we get into the origin story of your journey with Progenix and some of the other endeavors. You know, as a young man out of college, you know, did you know what path that you ultimately wanted to go down? Was it being an entrepreneur? Was it going into business and working for a big corporate? Like, how did that start for you?
To be honest, from a young age, I always felt like I wanted to work for myself. Not that I had challenges with like the idea of corporate America. I knew I was a free spirit, and I knew I liked the ability to take an idea and run with it. And, you know, I grew up in a great household, but my father was a military, and so it was very structured. So I was very used to structure. And so I'd always push against the structure, partly because it was just my dad. And so as it related to my professional aspirations, I knew deep down in my heart I'd always wanted to work for myself or work with a group of people. And at the time, obviously in high school or college, you don't really have the full scope of what you might do or what opportunities might open up for you. But I did deep down in my heart feel like entrepreneurship was the right way for me.
You have to listen to the inner voice. And even when you do that, it's still really daunting. And it's sort of like where do I start? And, you know, I've got a million great ideas. And which one of these am I going to lean into, right? Like, so how do you distinguish what the true opportunity is for you?
It's a great question, Ryan. To be honest, it's really like a love-hate type of relationship in the sense that you're really setting yourself up for some amazing life experiences, but also very challenging life experiences. And I think that the moment that you can accept that there will not always be great days as it relates professionally, there will be challenges and you will have to dig deep. Some people don't particularly enjoy that idea. And then some people, for me personally, I'm more concerned not having problems as it relates to work and trying to figure stuff out than I am when things are fine. And so, I feel like a lot of, for me at least personally, a lot of it was dictated by timing and opportunity. You know, it's like you have all these ideas and you think you can be having these amazing conversations in terms of why this next idea, your idea, is the right idea. But the timing could be wrong. You might not have the money. What's going on in the world might not be right. And so a lot of it, I don't necessarily believe in luck. I mean, I think you create a good portion of that, but a lot of it is timing and opportunity, and the stars, they don't have to align perfectly, but you got to have enough of them lining up for you to have an opportunity to build something.
What is that opportunity, or what was that opportunity to you as it relates to your journey into being an entrepreneur?
Each opportunity, oddly, Ryan, like, opened up other opportunities. And it's the strangest thing, but it's almost like this entrepreneurial world, like, people that aren't in it wonder what it's like. And then the people that are in it, they just kind of get each other, and different opportunities open up through casual conversations, through sharing some of the struggles or sharing some of the successes. Different things open up for you. And I feel like, you know, without getting off topic, you know, from an energy perspective, if you're putting it out there and you're putting it out there and you're seeking information, or you're seeking solutions for problems, or you're brainstorming a new concept, a new product, a new service, whatever, it might not be, I might be having an amazing conversation with you, Ryan. You say, you know what, this is great, but I know someone that you should talk to. And then you go and talk to that person, and your ideas kind of morph in that way. And I think, you know, for me, I consider myself very, very, very lucky. Amazing people that have come across my path, including you, at opportune times in my life, that have helped shape ultimately the path that I've gone thus far.
And there really is something to that, right? When you have this the spark of an idea, and then you mention that casually, and then somehow that person that you didn't even intend on opening up to says, oh yeah, you know what? I got a buddy that does something similar. You ought to talk. That is craziness. And it happens probably more often than not. You know, that really speaks to that, like, sort of like lean into kind of thing. But I think there's something more to that. And then I feel like if you say that and it falls on deaf ears, then clearly that was not the intended path for you. So let's jump into, so you start a marketing company. Is that, what was it, sports marketing? Was it?
No, you know, that's the funny thing, Ryan. So I graduated college, UC Santa Barbara, studied business economics with a minor in finance and accounting. I didn't want to be an accountant, but I knew, because I had this entrepreneurial spirit, I knew I would need to be able to navigate financial statements. And so I wanted that general understanding. And I had a very, very close friend of mine from childhood, to be honest, that was working at a marketing agency. And he and I always kind of kicked around this idea of being entrepreneurs. But neither he or I, you know, had parents that could help us buy a factory and start producing goods, or could send us overseas to, like, source product. We had limited means, and we were okay with that. And so when I find myself discussing the marketing business, it's such a general, like, marketing, what does that even mean? But it was truly like two childhood friends about the age of, I think we started at the age of 23, started the business with $6,000. And the concept was, we're going to go out and we're going to look for people that have a product or a service that either can't afford to market it, don't want to market it, don't have time to market it, that are willing to give a couple guys, young guys at this stage, a shot. That was kind of like the general scope. Like, we could create some excitement internally about that. And that's really how it morphed. You know, I feel like people would give us a shot more so, not because they felt we were talented or we could be talented, but we were young, honest guys that would work hard. And our model was actually crazy when I think back to it. But, you know, a lot of, if I can give you an example, Ryan, a lot of how I would present it is like, hey, Ryan, you have this product. For, as it relates to this conversation, the product is not the point. But you have this product, let me market it for you. And all I want you to do is wake up in the morning and ship that product to the people that I ask you to ship to, that I've sold to. If I do a marketing campaign and it does phenomenally well, that's great. We both win. If I do a marketing campaign and it fails, you're not paying me anything. I'm not, like, selling you marketing services. I'm trying to figure out how I can move some of your product, how much profit there is left on the table, and let's negotiate a split on that. And then so I felt like it was a win-win situation for anyone that would be willing to hear us. And that's kind of like how generic and simple the business model was.
I have a lot of thoughts on marketing and branding companies and agencies. And it's really funny because kind of like what you're saying, you know, when you're 23 years old and you're, you know, oh, I have a marketing company, like you said, like, what does that even mean? It almost sounds goofy. And then like, well, who are you? No offense to you. I'm just saying, like, generally speaking, like if someone came to me and was like, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm just out of college and I got a degree and I want to do a marketing company, I'd be like, dude, like what credentials do you have? Like, what have you done? What is your point of view? Like what problem have you solved for a company? And then there's the other side of the coin, which is the branding and marketing agencies that come along that have literally done nothing. And maybe they get one client because they got lucky. And then another brand goes, oh, they're working with so-and-so. And so I need to hitch my wagon to that branding agency. When in reality, the people running it have never done anything. They've never executed anything. And yet now they've kind of got the stable of brands built on air. And they're charging tons of money on retainer. And I've seen this for 20 years. And again, this is not you. I'm making a general commentary. And I continue to see this, and it's these guys that, you know, I've seen guys write books that have never had a job, that have never executed in a company in a professional way. And I just marvel at that. You know, on the flip side, you know, I ran marketing for 20 years and I've never touted myself as a marketer. So I'm just saying, you know, it's like, it's just kind of nutty how that happens out there. You're kind of offering a value proposition, which is at least, you know, there's some validation ultimately to you saying, hey, look, take a bet on me, right? Give me a chance. How do you open those doors? And how, you know, if you're a budding entrepreneur who's focusing on marketing, how do you create some of those pathways for yourself? And like I think you said, you know, you're creating a value proposition for a partner is a great way to do it. But coming in with a, you know, empty Rolodex is a really tough sell.
No, it's true. And I laugh to myself because you hear about these kids that are coming out of school and they're applying for jobs and they're like, this would be great. You'd be great, but you don't have experience. But you're like, that's why I'm here. I'm here to get a job so I can gain some experience. And I think that's really kind of where the timing and the opportunity really is most impactful, because I don't like the word luck or dumb luck, but for my first business, my partner and I, it was able to do what it did because one person said yes. And they said yes. And I took that yes as like, I'm going to sacrifice, I'm going to work, and I'm going to do my absolute best to do right by this person that bet on basically someone with empty Rolodex, no credentials. And for everyone that works, 10 don't. And that's just the reality of life, unfortunately. And I just feel like, you know, I don't consider myself a marketer either, but I do pride myself on, like, I'm going to work extremely hard. I'm going to focus very deeply. I'm going to try to figure out how I can position this product or service in a way that the customer will be compelled to buy it, to enjoy it, to come back, to talk about it, to do all these different things. And then it's just really, for me, you know, it's just rolling up the sleeves. I'm not, yeah, I went to college. I'm not the most well-read. I'm not this amazing writer. I know that. I know my deficiencies. There's areas that obviously I'm trying to work hard on, but I feel like the one variable that I can control, and a lot of people can't control, is how hard are you going to work? Are you going to really dig deep? And if you are, the chances are the success rate probably goes up exponentially versus like, I'm going to do this for 3 hours and then I'm going to moonlight, you know, doing something else just because I need to hedge my bet.
My dad used to just drill that in me, like, just work hard, outwork the guy next to you. And it's so true. Like, there's kind of like this fine point where that work all of a sudden hits this acceleration and you just go. And then the results become exponentially greater and greater, and the distance between you and the next guy gets greater and greater. It's so true. I mean, living proof, as are you. So the marketing company you've got going focuses on kind of what categories or...
See, that this really goes to timing, the timing piece, which was, it was very fortuitous timing. This is, I don't even remember, I'll call it this around 2003, four. You couldn't pick up a newspaper or turn on the TV without hearing about politicians talking about healthcare, health insurance, people with pre-existing conditions. It was a big thing. It was all over the place. You'd always, because people had pre-existing conditions, they'd have a hard time getting health insurance, and they were going to their constituents and looking to frame that up so these insurance companies would offer services. And so there was a network of about 300,000 doctors throughout the U.S. that aligned themselves and said, you know what, we're going to be willing to accept patients that have a pre-existing condition if they're a member of this network. If they pay for this membership, they're a member of this network, here's what our fees are going to be, and we're going to be willing to take any and everyone. And this was going on. We had done some, my partner and I had done some research, and it was really a timing thing because we weren't marketing geniuses by any means. Like, it was the news and the media was doing the marketing for us. We just had a product. There was an existing product out there that just needed to get into people's laps, and then they would buy. And we approached this network and we said, hey, we want to be a wholesaler for you guys. We're two young guys, and I think this is kind of where they gave themselves a laugh, said, okay, we have nothing to lose. Let's give these couple guys a shot. Here's kind of basically the rules. Here's how you present the material, and good luck. And so we started in a small office with myself, my partner, and three other people. And within 6 months, we got our second office. We're up to maybe 12 people. And within 2 years, we have 65 employees and the largest wholesaler in the country. It was crazy. And it was a wild, amazing ride. And again, as I sit here now, it's not like we had this like amazing marketing concept. The demand was just so high in terms of the amount of people with pre-existing conditions that needed something. Something was better than nothing. And then it was just a matter of getting that in front of them and presenting with the product, and the product was good, and it was a great network. And it just took off like a rocket ship. If we were to try to do that now, it wouldn't work, or it wouldn't work the way it did, because you know you're hearing about other things in the media that have got everyone hypersensitive about not pre-existing conditions and people not being able to get health insurance.
What's the so you do that for how long?
We did that for about 23 to about 28. So let's call it 5 years. And we interlaced a few other products that we were marketing, because at that time we had, you know, we're generating some revenue. We could hire some people. We had the infrastructure, kind of we got our mojo going. But we did it about 5 years, and the landscape in terms of how these memberships were offered to people started to change. And that's when we kind of recognized that the business model would have to pivot.
Do you have an exit strategy at this point, or like, what are you riding this thing? What's happening there?
Honestly, Ryan, it's crazy looking back, because like I said, I think we started about the age of 23, both of us, you know, childhood friends, middle school, I think maybe even elementary school. But so we'd hear these buzzwords, exit strategy and all that kind of stuff. But we were a couple guys just trying to work, learning at light speed, trying to get great people around us. And we weren't really thinking about exit. I don't think our business model was formal enough to contemplate exit, but we were generating enough revenue because of the way the model worked. It was a residual stream. So you're generating upfront money, but then you had this long tail that it gave us flexibility not to be like overly concerned about, hey, are we going to try to sell this thing? Let's just try to see what other doors open for us, because like I said, this was really a timing and opportunity, and we really wanted to be open-minded to what would be next, if anything.
We don't even get too into it, but did you have a partnership agreement in place? Or, you know, it doesn't sound like this was, because I can get at the end, it can get messy.
Yeah, no, not. I mean, I think we had an operating agreement, but this was a childhood friend of mine. And, you know, we were kind of cut from the same cloth, and we didn't, neither he or I, money. There was times where I'm sure the relationship, I'm sure if, you know, I was to talk to him now, there's times I'm probably sure where the relationship was a little bit strained just because you got all the stress and all these different things going on. Keep in mind, we're like 23, 24, 25 years old. Now all of a sudden we have 65 people running around. A lot of the people are even older than us. Like, you know, there was a lot of challenges, but we never really had any infighting. We never brought in outside money. It was a pretty straightforward deal. And to a large degree, that was a great helpful building block for me, just kind of understanding the inner workings of, you know, managing a partnership and a relationship.
That is a decent amount of staff to be, you know, dealing with at a young age. And, you know, talk about a limited toolbox, speaking for myself. You know, I've said it in prior podcasts, but, you know, it's like, you don't know what you don't know. And man, from a management point of view and leadership, the immaturity level was, you know, with me was just, it's embarrassing. Now look back, it's just, you know, you do what you do, and you know, I look back and just, oh man, I just would have handled certain things differently. It's, you know, and again, just given that age, it's, you're like, wild. Those are like wild and crazy years too. So not only, you know, is there an inexperienced level there, but there's like this, like, egocentric, you know, I'm the center of the universe kind of time in your life too, where you're, I don't know, speaking again of me, I wasn't really outward thinking at that point. It was really, you know, what's the best outcome for my ego or my, you know, my perception. So I don't know if you've felled any of the traps of that. You're, you know, probably not. Maybe it's just my immaturity, but I did feel like that, you know, was something I wish it was a do-over for me.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And you see it in all, you know, we've both seen it. And I think you're probably being more critical on yourself than you deserve, because I consider you one of the most grounded people I know. But I will tell you that, you know, if you pay attention and you observe, money does change people. It does. And you have to be careful with that. And I come from a very humble upbringing, and I'm proud of it, to be honest. And I'm thankful for it. I know what it's like to have to be mindful of your expenses and all that kind of stuff. And it served me well. And I've caught a lot of breaks in my life. But I always have that constant reminder of, like, you know, there's people that are less fortunate. There's people that are struggling. Things could be going great today, but not tomorrow type of mentality. And it's not like living in a state of fear, but I think it's just kind of owning up to, like, life is life, and you know, you can only predict so far, and you can only anticipate so much. And so, you know, as it relates to, you know, us being relatively young and starting to come making very good money, we kind of put the blinders up on that. You know, the money was a byproduct of what I was doing and what I really enjoyed. I mean, that's what was fueling me. It wasn't so much the money, and like, it just, if I was better at what I was doing, I happened to make more money, but I was really enjoying what I was doing. And that was kind of my driving force, if you will.
So how does the marketing company dovetail into the founding of Progenix?
As I briefly touched on, the way the marketing business worked is there was a long tail residual stream. So the cash flow to me and my partner was ongoing. And the landscape of marketing that product started to change, and we had an opportunity to bring down our operating costs and just take some time for ourselves. At that time, let's just call it 5 years. 5 years had gone by, and it was a wild ride. And I went and traveled. I said, okay, I've got a couple nickels in my pocket now. I'm not retired, but I don't need to, like, race out and start something new or get a job. I have that flexibility. And I started, like, kind of soul searching in terms of what I wanted to do next. Cause I genuinely, even still to this day, love working. I mean, working to me is like playing. And I'm a type 1 diabetic since the age of 5. And I always knew sports and nutrition, just from a lifestyle standpoint, was important to me. And, you know, when you do get some breathing room in your career to not have to like have a job per se, you know, the natural thing to do is like, hey, well, what do I enjoy? What am I passionate about? How do I want to be spending my time? And so I'd always kind of known that health and nutrition, whether it was helping kids with diabetes or whether it was sports management or whatever it was, I knew that was a path that interested me just from a personal level, not even professionally. And so in my travels, I kind of honed in on those inner voices. And when I came back, you know, I traveled various countries, and let's just say I took, you know, 3 or 4 months to myself or what have you. And I had the fortuitous timing again to bump into a guy at a conference that I was just kind of, I'm not even really sure what drove me to go, but I went. And his name was Aaron, my co-founder of Progenix. And he's the most amazing human being, full of energy, about the same age, passionate. He was there the same reason I was there, just kind of being open-minded. And I immediately knew he was someone that I would enjoy, I enjoy working with. And to take kind of a long, convoluted story in terms of the start, I can kind of piece it together with, you know, there was a doctor that had a formula for a protein, and he was later in his career. And I think he was looking for some people to help start a business, and he would be involved more from a high level strategic standpoint, but he didn't want to operate a business. I mean, it takes a lot, it's a lot of heavy up and down lifting. Even at my age now, like I think to myself, oh God, you know, like to do and expose myself to what I did when I was younger, it would be harder. And the stars aligned. Aaron and I, and then we got a couple other people, kind of put together a team and said, okay, we'll be the, you know, we'll start this business. And we have this, you know, this doctor, and he's got this formula, and he's well-established, great guy. Let's give it a go. And that's literally how it started. And, you know, Aaron, he had a strong network of people that trusted him, and he was in the financial space. And we knew we would need money, and he began raising money for the business, which ultimately was the birth of Progenix.
And so, again, we talk about timing, and maybe frame this in a bit for me. It's the years of the explosion of CrossFit. It seems like it was maybe around, 2010? 2018-ish kind of window, right? So, you know, I was big into CrossFit early on, and Brian McKenzie has been on the podcast, mutual friend of ours, and you know, was really deep and entrenched in it. And you know, I just remember going, and you'd see like Progenix was almost like synonymous with CrossFit. And so how does one sort of become entwined so deeply with the other? I mean, again, it sounds like the timing where like CrossFit's going bonkers and there's thousands of CrossFit boxes opening across the globe. And again, at the same time, it seemed like Progenix was the key player, the gold standard for supplements, performance products, recovery products. It just seemed like I saw the booth at the CrossFit Games, and I'm like, who are these guys? Like, from an admirer of marketing, like these guys are genius to piggyback on this and dovetail this movement and do the things that they're doing and have this massive presence and all these athletes. Like, what superhuman genius is behind this brand? How does that momentum happen, and how does the connection with CrossFit happen?
Thank you for that. And I'll tell you, again, it was a timing and opportunity standpoint, because the CrossFit community, I can't say enough great things about it. You know, it's a lot of like-minded people that, join together that want to work out, want to push themselves, like camaraderie, like all those things. And it's a community. I mean, it's the best way. Some might say community, some might say tribe or what have you, but it's a very close-knit community. And they're the most awesome human beings. Not all of them, obviously. There's never all of them awesome, but overall, the community was fantastic. But they weren't like super open to the idea of a supplement company like coming into their space, because traditionally they've composed nutritionists and they like raw food and meat and like all these natural stuff, which I like also, but they were not initially super excited about the idea of a supplement company, and which is fine. And that's, Aaron and I spent, a couple years on the road, going to these workouts, going to these barbecue things, setting up a booth and just sampling and just talking to people and sampling and talking to people and sampling and talking to people. And people started to see us enough because we were on the road nonstop. And I really think it was the community said, you know what, these guys, they're trying. Let's be open-minded. The product, I feel like people felt like, oh, product tastes good. How they're explaining it and what they're talking about makes sense. We're putting our bodies through a lot of stuff. We do need like good source of protein for recovery, all these different things. Let's give it a shot. And people started to give it a shot. And the beauty of community and tribe, if you will, is they talk amongst themselves. And so, there was no way to connect with a whole CrossFit community or every gym or visit every gym or go to every throwdown or do all these types of stuff. But the ones we did, we try to establish great relationships. We try to provide great service. We try to educate the best we could. We try to talk about why we felt our protein was better than others. And then we would let the product speak for itself. And, it wasn't really selling. It was more like trying to educate people. And then, enough people started to enjoy the product that they were doing the work. They were talking. They were creating the excitement about it. And, it's just one of these things where, like, looking back, we're thankful for it and humbled by the experience. But it wasn't all glory for the first few years. There was a lot of tough times setting up a pop-up booth in the rain while people are doing throwdowns and every, Saturdays and Sundays, because that's when these things were happening. It took a while. It took a while. And, Aaron and I spent a lot of time on the road, and the community was just, at the end of the day, the community is really what made the connection between Progenix and CrossFit happen, because, we could only do so much, but they are really what ultimately pulled us into their environment.
Was there any other startup company doing something similar to you, and did they get edged out, the progression into CrossFit, was it because you personally, you're a really fit guy, always have been, like, found that, hey, this is a type of workout format and community I really enjoy, and man, wouldn't these guys be well served? Or like, how did you identify that was going to be a market that was ultimately where you wanted to plant, some of the roots?
A lot of that, Ryan, was, obviously roundtable discussions, kind of getting an idea of ultimately what the strategy for the business was going to be. And, it again was timing, because at that time, CrossFit was really starting to pick up steam. You started seeing them pop up all over the place. And, obviously, like 24-hour fitnesses and some of those bigger chains had already existed, but they had kind of already identified their supplement partners and all that kind of stuff. And CrossFit at that stage wasn't really entertaining sponsorship type of things. I just think they weren't thinking about it at that time. I think there was like this anti-establishment kind of like, no, we don't want money. We don't want people kind of infiltrating our space. And so really the idea was, okay, there's clearly momentum here. These people are spending a good amount of money for their gym membership, so they're going to want good products. You're not going to like spend a high amount on a gym membership and then eat fast food every day. Just that typically that type of person's not doing that. And so we knew that they could support a higher price protein because it was higher quality, and that's just how it worked. And then it was just a matter of like, there really weren't a lot of barriers to entry. You show up to these throwdowns, say, hey, I want to set up a booth here? You know, can I sample to your guests? I'll give you some bags of protein. Not a lot of people, not a lot of gym owners are saying no to that. And so there wasn't a lot of red tape. You know, obviously CrossFit as it grew and Reebok came in and all these different things, it changed. You have to change. But when we really kind of got into the community, it was very informal, you know, barbecues. And then end of a throwdown, they would say, hey, come have a plate of chicken or what have you. And so it was a very organic, natural thing. And, you know, we were just fortunate to catch it at the right time.
So what does that trajectory look like for you? Like a couple years of like zero to flat business as you're kind of doing that? And then does it hockey stick? Like what are you piggybacking on the growth as these boxes are opening more and more, these boxes are carrying up? Like how's that growth happen?
I would attribute it largely to just us having opportunity to connect with more people and starting to get visibility and people starting to be more open-minded about supplements. And keep in mind, as it relates to the business model and connecting with the overall community, part of the approach was going to these gym owners and just saying, hey, listen, you have limited sources of revenue streams. You have gym membership and personal training. Basically, those are the two revenue sources for gyms. It's not much more elaborate than that. How would you feel about having a third one? And that always opened up, well, what do you mean? And so we kind of built this concept of business in a box. And the idea was, hey, Ryan, you own a gym, you're getting membership fees and you're getting personal training fees. This business in the box idea is interesting. You're going to have bags of protein delivered and your members will buy from you and you'll make the margin. And, you know, you as the gym owner are not gouging your members, but they're going to get a little bit better of a deal buying directly from you than buying from our website. And that's really how it started to take off, because we started promoting this idea of this business in the box and doing all the big events, hiring a sales team and starting to travel to the country. And all of a sudden you could create this additional revenue stream that didn't exist, couldn't have existed. And so there wasn't really a lot of friction as to, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I like the idea of, you know, making just enough money off of this to cover half of my rent or whatever the position it was from the gym owner. And that's what I think really propelled the growth, because, you know, they were opening CrossFit locations across the country quicker than you could imagine.
On that value proposition to them, were you saying, hey, we're going to consign this to you? Or were you like, hey, we are going to set up this rev stream for you, but you're going to buy it? Like, how did you do that? How'd you place it?
Yeah, we had to sell it. We had to sell it in, which, you know, that would be a hurdle. But we weren't pushing for these huge orders, you know? We would have to sell it just because it's a cash flow game. You're managing the cash flow. So, you know, putting on consignment, it can be challenging for a younger organization, just purely from a cash flow standpoint. So we'd sell it, we give them a good wholesale rate, and we'd also be committed to helping them sell it through. So like, Ryan, I'm selling this idea of the business in the box. I'm getting you to buy with me, but I'm also taking an active role in making sure that you have success with moving product. And that can be done in a lot of different ways. As simple as, you know, sending someone to do a sampling event where we provide the product at your gym. People try the product, they like the product, and now they see that you're selling it, they're going to buy it from you. We were not selling directly to the gym members. We were selling to the gym owners and allowing the gym owners to sell to the members. And so that model, I felt, served us well, because, you know, we could frame it up in a way that the gym owner wasn't really having to come out of pocket a ton. And, you know, they could do small frequent orders until they felt comfortable. And then, you know, you see with a consumable, like, if you don't give a person a reason to leave. I talk about this often when I'm thinking about different ideas. You price it fairly, you make a great product, you make it taste good, or you make it look good in that instance, and you support it. People will be loyal. If you give them a reason to leave, they'll leave and they'll have options. And that's just life. But, you know, it was a situation where these gym owners would see these small orders continue to grow, because after that bag was done, they needed another one and they needed another one, and they were talking amongst themselves. And so, you know, we have to give a lot of credit to the gym owners for helping us kind of push forward, you know, our goals.
I get a lot of this sometimes when I'm doing the podcast, and sometimes I brush over some detail, as you know, from an entrepreneurial journey. So the CrossFit scene's exploding, you're selling in. How are you financing this? Are you internally financing? Are you going to banks? Like, how, you've obviously got to buy a healthy amount of inventory. You're going to expand your product with, you know, by doing R&D. You got sponsorships of athletes, which I want to talk about. How are you, in those growth years, how are you doing this? I think this is really important for people out there to understand.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. And you know, you hear this buzzword, bootstrap. You know, people like say bootstrap. But a lot of it was that, you know, Aaron did have a network of people, great people, people that I'm still very close with, have a lot of love and respect for, but they were investors. They said, again, they said, I'll bet on you young guys. And I think we raised about, I'm going to just call it about $3 million. And we raised that money and then we bootstrapped the best we could. But we weren't really able to get traditional financing. And we didn't really push too hard to get traditional financing. I think looking back, I maybe, you know, with my more experience now, would have tried to form more of those relationships. But, you know, we did raise a decent amount of money and we were attempted to be diligent in how we managed that money. And we bootstrapped it from there and then allowed the business to fuel itself.
No, $3 million. I mean, I started another company after Paul Frank called Athletic Recon, which actually launched, you know, right in this groundswell of Progenics and CrossFit, and I was you know, alongside you guys a lot of times, physically with a booth, not to the granddaddy size you guys were. But when I hear, you know, $3 million raise, like I had sales the first year at Athletic Recon. And I mean, I was trying to do a friends and family round, and you know, people were like, "Yeah, I'll throw 25 or I'll throw 50 at it," and I'm like, "Nah, that's not going to do anything. I need like substantial money." So to say $3 million, I mean, how do you convince investors to get $3 million? Like, how do you? That's a big number, dude.
Yeah, it is a big number, and honestly, you know, I touched on it briefly earlier. Aaron's just such a phenomenal human being. I don't know how else to say it. And he had such strong relationships with these people. And this network, I'll call it a network of his dad and his dad's friends, you know, out of Kansas, farmers out of Kansas, people that just trusted him and his family. And that's, you know, honestly, Ryan, you've seen this in your life too. Like, if you gain someone's trust and you value their trust, raising money can be, I don't want to say easy, not easy, but a lot easier. And, you know, I can't say enough great things about Aaron, and he really managed that piece. I was more of like the engine, if you will, but he managed that piece, and he's just a phenomenal human being, and, developed a lot of trust with a lot of people that bet on. I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, if you think about it, for older people, you know, older people, whether they're going to country clubs or bingo or wherever they're going, they like to talk about things that they're doing. And sometimes it's kind of fun to say, hey, I invested in this young protein business with these young guys. It kind of makes them feel alive. You know, it's something exciting for them to be a part of. And then they start seeing the stuff we're doing in CrossFit, and they have, you know, that these things start coming up in their conversations. I think people like to be a part of that. And you're right. I mean, raising $3 million is not easy, but you know, with the right people and the right people that trust you, it's obtainable.
It goes without saying, you know, I'm sure at that point you already had a lot of momentum going. You're already getting established. You had a great game plan and a roadmap to capture all the white space. I know it just didn't fall in your lap. I know there was a lot of, you know, in addition to the relationships, there has to be a deck that's buttoned up and realistic. Did you have a relationship with CrossFit HQ? Like, how did they view Progenics? Because I feel like it was so synonymous.
Yeah, they initially no, like anything else, initially no. And, you know, when we started making overtures about being involved more from a sponsorship standpoint and kind of being the supplement brand of choice in these types of concepts, CrossFit was going through its own hyper growth stage. And so they hadn't really like formulated their model either. And yeah, we developed a relationship with CrossFit HQ, and they were phenomenal human beings. And once we kind of got past that, like, hey, we're not these corporate guys trying to infiltrate your space, trying to rip people off, trying to put garbage products into your community. Just give us a chance. You know, I'm oversimplifying it, but that's really the undertone of the message to CrossFit HQ. And, you know, CrossFit was doing what's known as, you know, the CrossFit, you know, finals or the CrossFit games at that time. And the athletes that were winning, I think were getting $500 or $5,000, something around that. I don't remember the exact number. And when we felt like we were ready, we went and we approached and say, hey, we'd like to be the title sponsor for the CrossFit games. And in exchange for that, you know, we want placement. We want all these different things. And then we're willing to pony up the purse money for the male winner and the female winner. And I think we put up $50,000 for each, I think. And so you have CrossFit HQ at $500 or $5,000, and you have these guys that don't really seem that slimy. They're kind of putting in the work, and they're willing to offer their athletes $50,000. Okay. And that's kind of how the relationship, I'm oversimplifying it as you get it, but CrossFit HQ, they too gave us a chance. And then their whole sponsorship model changed. Obviously after that, their whole sponsorship model changed, and you end up having Reebok come in for like, I think $100 million or something.
That was going to be my next question was, yeah, that sounds like a deal, you know, pre Reebok. Reebok, you know, they went in, right. What was the trifecta? They went like Spartan Games, CrossFit, and the UFC. Was that right? Is that right?
I think so. I mean, Reebok, I think at that time was under a lot of pressure because their brand equity was suffering, and they saw this community and all these amazing things about CrossFit. So it made sense why they wanted to come in, but no one really knew how to read HQ about it, because for the longest time, HQ was anti-establishment. You know, we don't like 24-hour fitness. We don't want that. We're the people, which I respect. And so it was a paradigm shift for them to then come in and bring in corporate money, especially at that amount.
What a stroke of genius to go, hey, we're gonna be the title sponsor at that time when again the big giant brands weren't. I mean, I know they were all eyeing it, right? But they weren't necessarily toe in yet. So good on you guys for doing that. And you worked with, I imagine, some of the key athletes of the day too. Were you guys with Froning?
Yeah, with Rich, Jason, a lot of I call them, they're great human beings, first off. But as it relates to the athlete approach, I and Aaron would like to call it the tastemakers. Basically, they're the guys that like say, hey, this is what I do, this is what I'm using. And everyone else says, okay, we want to do that as well. And so they also, you know, had limited revenue opportunities. And so this was a new one. And the idea was, you know, they would sell product at their gyms. Also, we wouldn't pay for them to say stuff that they didn't believe, but we would want to consider them like a Progenics athlete. And so we would go after developing what we would call a tastemaker team of people. And, you know, CrossFit would have seminars. So a lot of time you have the elite athletes there, and we would just try to show them as much respect and love that we could, show their gyms as much respect and love as we could, and do different things for them. And in exchange for that, you know, allow us to call them, you know, a Progenics athlete.
I love the genuineness, and it's inherent in your nature. It's just where you come from. And I love it. And there's a place for it in business, man. It doesn't all have to be predatory, right? Like it doesn't need to be that way. So let's dive into distribution for a second. So you're in the boxes. What a great, you know, this great idea again, offering the additive sale to all these captured you know, customers literally in these boxes that are, they're looking at all the athletes you're now sponsoring, you're the title sponsor against you. Now you've got all this credibility. So that channel seems to me like it's kind of now taking care of itself. Are you approaching the GNCs and the Walgreens? Like, how do you navigate the, like, hey, we don't want to look like sellouts, but we have to continue growing and supporting our business. Take me through the distribution strategy. What was your, like, how are you positioning the brand during this explosive growth?
You know, a lot of people have this fascination with big box. That's when you arrive, you get to big box. But
right.
It's a whole different bag of tricks, to be honest. And I think this big box thing is actually changing with the, you know, obviously how much Amazon has like changed the way people buy stuff. But, you know, we looked at it, but we weren't ready. We weren't ready. And a lot of people don't fully appreciate what it's like. You know, if you do get one of those big boxes take you on, they want terms and they want marketing dollars and they want all these things. Your work, you know, you sell the product into them. You're not done. That's actually when the work starts. And so we just weren't ready. And we kicked it. We kicked the idea around and we kind of had an idea of, you know, how much cash we would need to have to support it and product to support it. And at the time, you would never want, you know, the CrossFit community who got you to where you were suffer because you're making this next step. And we just weren't ready to, there's no fancier way for me to say it than that. We thought about it. We contemplated it. We gave it some consideration. It was not a shoe-in. Like, we would have to go and sell the idea of what carry our product versus someone else. But we just, it the timing wasn't right for us. And it was the right call.
I feel like that's just on the cusp of the era of the subscription models. Were you able to tap into that, or was that a little bit before the Progenics explosion? Or
we did have a subscription model because it is a consumable, and people, you know, typically are using the product within 30 days. And again, if you're mindful of the customer experience and don't give them a reason to leave, they won't. And so we had a, you know, subscribe and save button, and you know, people can enroll and give them incentives to do that, because then a day, you know, that's really what you want. You want a loyal customer. You want to get your acquisition cost as low as possible. And then you want to stay focused on giving them an awesome experience from start to finish and rolling out new SKUs and all that kind of stuff. The bigger your subscriber base is, the more revenue you can generate. And so we put some horsepower around that. And, you know, we found it, including the CrossFit boxes. You know, that was more of like a white glove treatment, but they were kind of, if you think about it, they were kind of on a subscription model also, like, hey, every 15 or 20 or 30 days, I need to re-up and I need to re-up and make a bigger order. And so we were mindful of that.
So you did always resist the temptation of the chain stores and the big box stores, or towards the end, did it happen?
They weren't. I definitely want to not misrepresent. They weren't chasing us. So like, it wasn't like, oh, we're fighting them off. Like it was always a lane that existed. We knew it existed. Most people do, but you have to make a conscious decision to say, okay, I want to go after that lane. And internally we just determined that, going after that lane was, not right at that time. And so we weren't, it was not like we were having to, you know, send GNC to voicemail and not return their letters, or we weren't having to do that. I think looking back, you know, maybe a few more years in, we probably started looking at it, but I personally am not that, huge of a lover of the idea of needing the big box model to work, because I think there's today, in today's day and age, there's a lot of ways to connect directly with your customer. And you just want to give them the convenience. If they happen to enjoy going to the big box and that's where they like to buy, you want to be there because you want to take care of your customer. And your customers really dictate, ultimately, I think, what you should and shouldn't do.
I love that so much. I think it's really important for those, you know, young entrepreneurs that are tuning in right now. Like, and you said it, like, sometimes when you enter those big box channels, or multi-door channels, even, that's really when the real work begins. And what ends up happening is it becomes a business within a business that you're now operating. And maybe you don't have the personnel, the bandwidth, the financing, the marketing dollars. And so, yeah, maybe these POs are rolling in, but you don't have the ability to split yourself in half. And now you're running and babysitting and fostering two or three channels of sales, and it can wipe you out. And again, so you know, you're looking at that carrot that's dangling out in front of you. I would be very hesitant. And it sounds like you really listen to that inner voice, which I think is so rare, because I think you probably realized you could have added millions to the bottom line had you chose to go down those paths, and you resisted that. And I think that's a really great play. And again, for authenticity, for particularly for the market share you were servicing, like, you really knew who your customer was. And I think you knew, and I'm putting words in your mouth, but like, if you did big box, some of that culture would be like, you're a sellout. And now I don't want, I'm over it. I'm going to go to the next organic indie guy in the space.
For sure. It was definitely a concern. And, I often, whether it's personally or professionally, I lean into this concept. I maybe have shared it with you before, maybe not, I don't know. I call it my true north. And it really stems from the idea of this compass, right? Your compass, you know, when you're standing with your compass and you have a true north. And I really feel like if you're mindful of your personal true north, it's speaking to you. It's helping you guide you. You don't always make the right decisions, but most of my mistakes in my life have been a byproduct because I really wasn't tapping into my true north. My true north was talking to me, but I was kind of numbing it out. And for Aaron and I think through internal discussions, you know, our true north was telling us that this, while it's tempting, is not the right move. Because the whole dynamic changes. You get the big POs and you got to support and you got to do all these different things. But then you might need to bring in money. And then you need to bring in money, and you might need to bring in money from people that aren't your friends and family. And they have different agendas. And they have different ways they want to do stuff. And so it's this snowball effect that you kind of got to protect. And eventually you got to make that step and you got to be comfortable with it. And you got to be okay with being vulnerable and dealing with the dynamic of a board and different types of people. But from a timing perspective, it wasn't right for us.
I love it, man. Just share a quick story. Last night I got a text from a buddy that used to run part of our production at Paul Frank, and he's like, oh, I just found this in my brother's closet and I wanted to send it to you. And it was a picture of imagine the Fonz back on Happy Days, like this leather jacket. And I wrote back to him and I said, we must have been in a severe crisis mode to make that stupid thing. So like, and he wrote back, like, I thought you might say that. We were so, if I'm making a leather jacket, and like, what am I doing? I'm so far from my true north. What were we doing? Anyway, I just share that to just show you how quick you can get derailed into thinking like, yeah, you can just, you know, you can pull all these levers. Oh, we can do all these things. We can add sales here, but, you know, stay on course, stay on track, do what you do, be genuine. It goes a long way.
The best you can.
Yeah, the best you can, right? You do get pulled. I mean, right? You do get starry-eyed, you know. People, you get attracted by a big PO. The next thing you know, you're taking a left turn and see ya. So I know there was some stuff in the end maybe you can't get to, but what is the status of Progenics today? How did you exit, you know? And I want to transition that into your next gig here.
Yeah. So Aaron and I, we built up a lot of momentum, and you know, obviously had to grow the team and bring people in. And we started having internal friction, if you will, not to oversimplify, but let's just call it internal friction. Different outlooks in terms of how things should be done. And at the end of the day, you know, Aaron and I felt really compelled to do what we felt was our true north, and we had an opportunity to get out. We didn't really like some of the ideas that were circulating. And anytime you have partnerships, and I'm sure have seen this in your career, I view there's the world as like two types of entrepreneurs. You've got your entrepreneur like Orion that's going to roll up his sleeve and do whatever he needs to do to make it successful, and it becomes, I don't like the word passion project, but you love what you're doing. You care about what you're doing. It's a reflection of you, and that's one type of entrepreneur. And you have another type of entrepreneur, and I'm not saying one's better than another, but the other type of entrepreneur is someone that wants the security of a job. You know, they want to have this thing going. They want a job. They want to be comfortable, and that they're okay with that. And I'm not casting shade on that type of person, whatever. But Aaron and I were more the entrepreneur. Like we love stuff because we loved it and we wanted to see it grow. And so when, you know, the internal climate started to shift, you know, Aaron and I navigated the best we could, and we had an opportunity to get out, to be frank. And that's what we did. And you know, I think from a timing perspective, it was the right time. I think directionally there was things going on in the organization that just didn't align with our overall vision. And the challenge is, Ryan, in life, you know, as you have to bring in, when you're growing at the rate we're growing, and you have to bring in other personalities, and you just have to, and sometimes they align well and sometimes they don't. So Aaron and I had a chance to get out. That's what we did. You know, it ended up being the right choice. My understanding is the relationship from CrossFit dissolved quickly. CrossFit ultimately actually ended up suing Progenix, got a very large judgment, and I think they went into foreclosure. A lot of stuff happened that weren't ideal. But for Aaron and I think we got it to the spot the best we could. And once the kind of climate changed, we got out the best we could. And looking back, I think that's the best way to describe it.
That's awesome. I would like to spend a few minutes on your next gig. So you and we're going to hit the speed up button here. You get tapped to become the COO of Liquid IV, which again, it's so rad. Like I love that stuff. I found it, I think, pretty early on, and then come to find out, like you're part of the driving force behind that brand. And I think we had some pretty early conversations with that as well. And so maybe just give us a sense of like what you were tasked to do there, and maybe paint the contrast or similarities between your prior gig and what you were now going to do.
I can't say enough good things about the Liquid IV experience and the team. You know, I was fortunate enough to get introduced to actually a mutual friend, BK, and BK was on the board. And at the time, Liquid IV had two co-founders and one ops guy. So three people. And I think they're all under the age of 30. It was amazing. And BK was looking to kind of like build a team and help give some support to the younger talent. And he brought me in, and I can't say enough amazing things about the co-founders of Liquid IV, just awesome human beings. At this stage of my life, I had this love hate for startups. And in my mind, I thought, you know what? I've been doing startup world for the last, whatever, 15 years, let's call it. I'm done. Like, I'm done. But I met with BK, and he said, come up to LA, come meet the founders and just stay open-minded. And that's what I did. And it's just a awesome group of human beings. It was so early, so young. And that approach was much different in contrast to Progenix, because it was at a very formal board and with people that were very well connected, that were giving the founders great advice, and they wanted Big Box in a big way. And they made it clear that the funding piece would be obtainable and just work very hard. And obviously I'm being mindful of fast forwarding a lot of struggles, but that was kind of the mantra, like get the Big Boxes, support them the best you can, prove out the pull through, and the rest will take care of itself. And largely that's what we did. I spent a good amount of time on the road, the benefit sometimes with the founders, sometimes without, pitching Big Box and kind of talking about this new category of like hydration. Gatorade's been around forever, but this rehydration category didn't really exist. When I say category, you're talking about how Big Box's shelves are framed. They have categories and they have buyers for each category that are responsible for what's going on in that space. And so the space was really, it was raw. It was like people a lot of time didn't know where should we put you? Where on the shelf should we put you? Because it was a category that really wasn't defined. And again, this is back to timing and opportunity. It was the opportunity was ripe for a business like Liquid IV. The founders were the right people to launch that business. The founders had an amazing board that were very sophisticated in how they were looking at things. And you know, the ability to come in and join that team was just a great life experience.
What a stark contrast, right? From kind of this bootstrapping to like, oh, you got structure, you got a board, you have a mission, you're on growth mode. I'm sure they were obviously clearly still, you know, really important to establish their brand and their identity and make a distinction between the benefits of that versus a Gatorade, which I understand is what like a 3-to-1 like force multiplier on your hydration level per pack. I mean, what a great proposition. Yeah, I want to be 3 times as hydrated. Like, sure. Yeah. And so you're on. So when you're on, you're hired on. There's inside of 5 people. What's the size difference between like a, you know, when Progenics is kind of running full tilt on the staffing versus Liquid IV? I mean, are you guys like the intent is like, hey, we're going to run this lean and mean and operationally, or like, what did the staff sizing look like?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely lean and mean, and you know, it was still unproven. So it's not like the board was like blank checking things. We're still very mindful of, the balance sheet and the bank statements and, you know, making sure that we could navigate the storm. But a lot of what the growth was, it was timed properly in the sense that we staffed it as related to need. You know, when we knew we needed to hire more people, that's what we did. And if we needed to raise more money, that's what happened. And so it wasn't, you kind of get in this situation where you're not going to allow your business to suffer because you're unwilling to go out and get what the business needs. And, you know, if the business needs more money, you go get more money. If the business needs a certain skill set, you go get a person with that skill set. And so the ramp up period, I mean, I think for the first, during my tenure, for the first year and a half was pretty darn lean and mean, you know, and everyone loved what they were doing, very passionate about what they're doing, probably doing 2 or 3 people's jobs, but that helped you kind of navigate it. But it didn't really need to be bloated. You know, you could get by with lean and mean. Someone was good with the accounting, the financing piece of it. And, you know, a lot of the time, I think a big common problem with businesses, they bite off more than they can chew. And there's no like formula for like, when is it right to like staff up aggressively, you know, but it's like a pulse. You kind of got to be mindful of the pulse of the business and where you're slowing things down because you don't have adequate staffing is a problem. There's an opportunity cost connected to that. And so just kind of being very mindful of that. And I think when you build these processes and structures, these things start to become more obvious quicker. They become more, you have more checks and balances that they speak to you if you pay attention. And if they speak to you and you hear it and you make the adjustments, I think that's what a well-balanced business, in my opinion, should do.
Okay, so how long was your run at Liquid IV?
I think I was at Liquid IV for about 2 years. The only downside I'll ever share about my Liquid IV experience was it was in LA.
That's a huge downside.
So for me, and I'm not speaking. I live in Newport Beach, like it, it was a big strain. And I was very kind of mindful of what I was brought in to do at a period of time very early. And I just, you know, my family's here, my folks are older. Moving up to LA was, it never even crossed my mind. And I'm not at this stage of my career, like, even if, you know, sometimes people say, oh, maybe you stayed longer, could you imagine how much more and this and that? Yeah, perhaps. But like money, like at this stage of my life, like, it wasn't important to me. I just knew that's not how I wanted to be spending, you know, a couple hours a day, every day in a car in traffic. And I felt like I was able to do what I was brought in to do and not necessarily overstay my welcome. And I love them and I love the experience. But for me, when it was a kind of a wrap, it was the right time for it to be a wrap for me because I was at that point kind of done with the commute.
That's a grind. A tough grind to ask of anyone. So look, you're batting 3 for 3, right? You start the marketing. You're humble. I know you and you don't like compliments, but I'm going to give you one. You're 3 for 3 and you have great intuition and insight. Can I just extract from you maybe some habits, some tools that you deploy consciously or unconsciously that help foster this performance at a high level? Like what are some of the things you do, or, you know, maybe they're lifestyle habits that feed into your career, but
First off, thank you for the compliment. I wouldn't say 3 for 3, but I appreciate it. I think for me, even, you know, now I'm 46. It sounds crazy to say that. I love working. I don't know how to better explain it. Like as kids, you know, when they get out of school and they love to go play with their friends and then they have to come home and do their homework, but they love playing with their friends. When I wake up and I go to an office or meetings, like to me, that's like play. I love it. And so I'm very passionate about what I'm doing. And I think that's super important because you're not going to half-ass something that you're passionate about. You're just not. And to me, I think I listen to what I know I enjoy, and I do have a lot of structure. I think innately a byproduct of being a diabetic, you know, since the age of 5, you know, I'm always thinking about when's my next meal? What am I having? You know, making sure I'm always kind of not put in situations that I'm not prepared for. And that's kind of bled into all aspects of my life. So I wake up every morning at 5:45. I meet my mom. I do a 30-minute walk with my mom, who's 85 years old. Every day I do my workout, I do my cold plunge, I do my sauna. It sounds nuts. Even as I talk about it, it sounds nuts. But by 10 in the morning, I'm ready to roll. And I've got my mind, my body, and my spirit in a spot where like I'm ready to go. And I love it. You know, my girlfriend often, you know, not criticizes, but makes fun of me. Like I get thrown off when I go on vacation and stuff like that because it throws off my routine. But I love my routine. And so from a structure standpoint, for me, that's what works best for me. For some people, that sounds horrible, but and that's fine. My formula is not the formula for everyone. But for me, that's what works.
A lot of structure. And what you just described means, you know, a lot of discipline. And that's really, really important. What else I got for you? What would you say to a budding entrepreneur who wants to start a business? I mean, you've been through a lot of startup. Any nuggets or things you want to, you know, share to someone who, you know, pitfalls, things like that?
I think, you know, for someone who's aspiring to start a business, I think, you know, probably the most important thing I would encourage them to do is be mindful of your brand equity and get good people around you and ask them questions, ask them favors. Don't be afraid of looking vulnerable. Don't try to be the smartest guy in the room, whether you are or not. I'm definitely not, and I know I'm not. But getting great people around me in my career is the only way that I was able to do some of the stuff I've done, and stay humble in that approach. You know, people, I think naturally there's more good people than bad. And I think naturally people want to do business with people that they like. It's just, it's a natural thing. I got to do business. You got to do business. Why would we choose to do business with someone that we don't like when we have an opportunity to do business with someone we do like? And so I think being very mindful of that. I know in today's day and age, things are changing with how people communicate and all that kind of stuff. I'm old school. I grew up old school household. Like, I'm all about relationships. Always, always, always. And, you know, I would always encourage people, get awesome people around you, beat up ideas, talk about them, be open to constructive feedback. Not everyone's always going to agree with you. A lot of time people don't want to poo-hoo a new idea because they don't want to kind of be a dream crusher, but invite it. Invite someone to poke holes through stuff because you'll be thankful that they did.
Excellent sage advice. We're running low on time. You're running low on vocal cord strength. Dude, thank you so much for coming on today. It's always a pleasure. I've really enjoyed our time. I've learned a lot. This is rad. And again, thank you for being a sport. I know your voice is going. It's going to be fine on the recording. All good. I'm sure everyone out there can hear you. But you probably need some tea and some honey at this point. So I'm going to just graciously say thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. It's a great honor to be with you and super proud of all the stuff you've done and stuff you've done with the show.
Well, thanks. You're a great inspiration. All right, Cameron. Well, cheers to you and on to the next venture. Thank you, my brother.